Welcome to Deconstructed. I'm TJ O'Hara, the principal political analyst for IVN, the Independent Voter Network. Our goal on Deconstructed is to break down important political issues with outstanding guests so you can develop your own, more informed opinion. My guest today is Kitty Kurth, president of Kurth Lampe Worldwide. She's a public relations and political strategist with Chicago know-how and global reach. Kitty has worked on 8 presidential campaigns, including 2 Clinton Gore and Obama Biden tickets. In that capacity, she served in the roles of press secretary, campaign manager, and communications advisor. And since 1996, she's worked with speakers at the Democratic National Convention to help them deliver their messages more effectively. With what's happening nationally and in the Chicago area, we're going to have a lot to talk about. So without further ado, welcome to Deconstructed, Kitty.
Thank you, TJ. I'm happy to be here. And what all that resume really just says is I'm an old political hack who's been around for a while.
And a very good one. You know, I've had the opportunity to work with you directly, and I've always been impressed with your professionalism and the political relationships you've established over the years with some of our nation's top leaders. And one of those relationships is particularly relevant today. And I'm talking about the one with Joe Biden. You were at the forefront of the Draft Biden initiative, as I recall, back in 2016 when he chose not to run. Can you give us some insight, at least from your perspective, as to why Joe didn't choose to run in 2016?
Yes. And I've got to tell you a little bit about the Draft Biden in 2016, because the backstory is just as good as the fact that we were so close to getting him to run in 2016. There was a young veteran named Will Pierce who was sitting in Chicago on his couch with one of his friends who happened to be a lawyer. And he was like, you know, I wonder what it takes to create a super PAC. So they went online to the FEC. They looked at the guidelines. They initially invested $5 and created a super PAC that became Draft Biden. It just goes to show you all politics really is local and a grassroots movement can really move. So they went from 2 kids sitting on a couch, $5. They got Joe Biden so close to getting in the race. We had paid organizers in Iowa, Nevada, New Hampshire, South Carolina. We had more field staff in the next round of states ready to go. They had 250,000 unique donors. In addition, we had been in talks with the actual Joe Biden campaign over the weekend, the Chinese firewalls that have to be in place between a super PAC and a campaign. The lawyers were working to take them down so that the super PAC could transition into the campaign. All this was happening over a weekend. And suddenly, on Tuesday morning, we turned on the TV and Joe Biden was walking into the Rose Garden to say that he was not running for president.
Kitty, do you think he missed his window of opportunity back in 2016?
TJ, that is a really, really hard but fair question. And as someone who, you know, I adore Joe Biden, I like his politics, I like the man, but I think you might have just hit the nail on the head. I think 2016 historically was probably his window of opportunity to run. He didn't want to run against Hillary Clinton ultimately, for a variety of political reasons, which I understand, but I think that the national political climate has changed so much in 4 years that it would or will be very hard for him to run this time. And he has said to me personally, you are never as popular in politics as before you get in the race. So right now, he's doing great in the polls, but the minute he gets in, I think the only thing that would happen is he would drop for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, he's comfortably leading in the polls right now, but as you say, he isn't running and he's already been attacked. And I guess
exactly.
In that capacity, is the latter to be expected or a strategy that could damage the party?
Both, all of the above. You know, I am not surprised about the criticism of Joe Biden's personal space. He is a very touchy-feely, old-school, huggy guy. That, quite honestly, is one of the things that I like about him, is that he shows his humanity. But I understand that in this era of Me Too, it can be misconstrued. People have different comfort levels. I mean, I came from a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant family that didn't hug nearly enough. One of the reasons I got into politics was to get hugged more. but I get that's not for everybody. But, you know, times have changed. This is not the 80s. This is not the 90s. It's a different time. People have different boundaries. And I have personally, at every rally and every event, seen Joe Biden hug and shake hands and touch and communicate closely with hundreds of people at every single event I've done with him. So are there one or two that are going to say like, oh, well, I was uncomfortable when he got too close to me? Yes, more people are going to come up and say that. Do I think that there's anything nefarious in the way that Joe Biden approaches people? Absolutely not. But he's still going to get criticized for it.
On that point, he's always done it outwardly. He's done it on camera. So this isn't anything new. Anybody who's followed Joe Biden over the last 40 years knows that he is an outwardly affectionate guy. So is it fair, if he changes his behavior now, is it fair to judge his behavior 20, 30, 40 years ago by the standards of the Me Too movement?
It won't matter if it's fair or not. People will. But the one thing I will say is you nailed it too on this point. It's always out in the open. It's not like this happens in a back room somewhere where he's alone with somebody. It's in the middle of the backstage area at a rally. It's when he meets somebody online at a political event. I have seen him call people's moms from every single event. You know, people will come up to him and say, oh, my mom loves you. And I'll say, well, great, let's get her on the phone. You know, he'll be hugging the person on the phone. He'll be talking to mom with the other hand. They'll be taking a selfie with the phone. He is a gregarious, charming, engaged guy. But we are all being judged now for things that we did 40 years ago that looking backwards always looks different.
How much do you think being a quote-unquote insider, part of the establishment, and an individual who's actually worked across the aisle and has Republican friends and is willing to admit it, although, you know, he does it in a humorous way when he gets criticized. How does that play in today's Democratic Party?
I think in today's Democratic Party, that will hurt him, which is crazy. It should help him. You know, in order to get legislation passed, you still have to talk to one another, as far as I know. But I think in this day and age, there are people, especially on the far left wing of the party, that just do not want us to communicate at all with other people. It's a very, very different atmosphere than the one that Joe Biden was used to in Washington all those years when he worked hard to get legislation passed. It's a different day. It's a different era. Things look and feel different, and people are judged differently.
Kitty, we're going to take a quick break and talk more about a possible Joe Biden presidential run when we come back. Welcome back. My guest is Kitty Kurth, a longtime Democrat insider, both at the national level and in the Chicago area. Kitty, we were talking about a possible Joe Biden presidential run. Let's assume for a moment that he does announce that he's getting in the race within the next few weeks, and I think that seems to be the targeted time frame. He's also had pushback, not only for being establishment and maybe outwardly too affectionate, as the, I hate to even frame it this way, old white guy, because that has an age implication that he's out of touch. It has a racial implication, and it even has a implication that as a man, he's somewhat running at a deficit. How do you see that playing out within the context of the party?
So interestingly, I'm going to take the toughest one first, the white part. One of the things that was fascinating to me during the Draft Biden movement, our largest segment of supporters, our biggest support was amongst African-American women 40 to 65. That was the biggest chunk of the Draft Biden supporters, which was so interesting to me. I don't think that the white part of being an old white guy is his hardest part, because he does have so much loyalty in the black community because they appreciated the way that he treated President Obama, the way that he stood up for President Obama, the way that he was a true team partner with President Obama. But I think the older part is a problem. Not because he isn't in great shape and because he isn't physically up to doing the job. I think he absolutely is. But I think the electorate has changed since 2016. I think the electorate was also encouraged by the fact that when we got new candidates, young candidates with different perspectives and different voices into races at every level, from Senate to Congress to local school board, we found they were electable. You don't have to be an old white guy with a lot of experience in order to get elected anymore. And I think that the voters are realizing that and realizing that they have a lot more choices. And even though everyone loves Joe Biden, everyone might not want him to be president anymore.
Any particular issue from a party perspective with him being a male?
Yeah, just, you know, the same as for all of the guys. I hear three times a day three different arguments. You know, a woman can't beat Trump. Only a woman can beat Trump. I'm tired of a man. I really want a man because we need a man to beat Trump. You know, I literally hear these arguments all day, every day, and I don't even know how I feel about them. One of the things that I, as a voter, am really excited about, and if Joe Biden gets into the race, it will only make it better. I am so excited to hear the diversity of ideas from this very diverse field. Young people, older people, women, men, different ethnicities, different backgrounds. I am so excited, and I've kind of become a total geek nerd to watch every CNN town hall with every candidate, because I'm so excited to hear all these different ideas that I'm hearing. You know, candidates that I hadn't heard much from before, like Andrew Yang and Marianne Williamson. I'm not an Oprah girl, so I had never heard Marianne Williamson before, but I was blown away by her and by the strength of her ideas and the depth of her knowledge. I want to hear more from Mayor Pete. I want to hear more from Julian Castro. I know what Joe Biden stands for. I know that I agree with him on a million things, but I also know that the country has a lot of challenges, and maybe people want to hear from people with a different background. I think that's Biden's challenge, is that he does have the experience. He is the same kind of candidate. That's his toughest challenge and his biggest asset. I think fundraising is also a challenge. He is not as used to the kinds of money that has to be raised in the race. And, you know, when you look at what Kamala Harris and Cory Booker and Bernie Sanders have raised so quickly, maybe he can do that. Maybe he can't. We don't really know, because he hasn't had to do that before. He has done a lot of the higher dollar fundraising, but where a lot of these candidates are getting their strength is from the smaller donors who, you know, once you go back to them once, you can go back to them every month and keep getting more.
Absolutely. Great observations. Now, we've talked about some of his obvious challenges, and you know they're going to raise, and they already have, the Anita Hill testimony, and the history of Bobbles are going to be coming out if he enters the race. But let's talk about his relative strengths as compared to the myriad of other candidates for the Democratic nomination.
Well, I think one thing that voters have shown both in 2016 and 2018 in the races we've had up until now, I think people are ready for somebody who speaks their mind. They want honesty. They want integrity. And I think that's something we get with Joe Biden in spades. You know, even when he makes a gaffe, or what the media calls a gaffe, I would call it speaking the truth. You know, he calls it like he sees it. He says what's on his mind. And I think voters connect to that. I think even Republican voters connect to that. They know you're not going to get any malarkey with Joe Biden.
And what other qualities do you see that contrasts and compares favorably on Joe's part with the other candidates?
Foreign policy and his, not only his work in foreign policy for decades, but the close personal connections that he has with world leaders. And after our current administration, we have a lot of rebuilding of relationships to do, both with the NATO countries, with the EU, with our friends in Asia, with certainly with Canada and Mexico. And Joe Biden has those relationships dating not only to his service as vice president, but to his long years of service on the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate. He's got friends all over the world who know him and trust him and know that they can pick up the phone and talk to him, and that what he says inside the room will be the same as what he says outside the room.
That's an excellent point of differentiation. What candidates do you think present the greatest challenge to a Biden candidacy?
Boy, ask me this week and I'll have one answer. Ask me next week and I will have another answer.
Okay, well, consider yourself invited back next week.
But I truly think the most exciting part of this courtship with all the candidates is we get to go on a new date every week. You know, this week we're learning more about Mayor Pete. A couple of weeks ago, we were learning more about Beto O'Rourke. When Kamala Harris announced, we were learning more about her. I think all of these young and older leaders, I think everyone from, you know, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren down to Marianne Williamson and some of the people with life experience down to the Julian Castros and Mayor Pete's and Tulsi Gabbard's, I think all of them have something to say. Jay Inslee, who, you know, he's all about climate change. I want to hear more about climate change from him. I want to hear more about UBI from Andrew Yang. I want to hear more about the Department of Peace from Marianne Williamson. I want to hear more about Tim Ryan's ideas for how we can get back the Rust Belt. I think every voice that's in the race right now deserves to be heard and has something to say. Poor John Delaney, who's been camped in Iowa for a year, the people of Iowa know him and know what he has to say, but the national stage keeps forgetting he's out there, even though he's probably got the strongest campaign going in Iowa. But the challenge is going to be breaking through. But the media forgets that we are so much at the beginning of the process, and there are so many months and so many dialogues to be had. Everybody should just relax and listen.
And very quickly, before we go to break, how great a role will identity politics play in the Democratic nomination?
I think there's so many people with so many different backgrounds that it's identity politics is almost off the table because you can't say that all of these people are going to be for this candidate. I think all the boundaries are broken.
That's good news.
In a good way.
I agree. Kitty, we're going to take a quick break and talk more about national politics and how Chicago has been part of that spotlight in recent weeks when we come back. Welcome back. My guest is Kitty Kurth, a well-known political strategist for the Democrat Party and its candidates. Kitty, we've been talking about Joe Biden, but let's move to Chicago politics and what's been transpiring there, because you've had a number of issues that have been in the national news. Let's start with the obvious, Jussie Smollett, or should I say Jesse, now that Chris Rock has stripped him of the U. He came out with allegations that were at least challengeable. The police met that challenge, toggled back and forth. It had hate crime written all over it. We talked about Joe Biden, who I find to be very measured in his approach to situations. And some of his potential primary challengers took the bait. They referred to it as a modern day lynching. And then the facts started evolving. But it's become even more interesting since we've been introduced to new words like alternative prosecution, which as a former litigator, I hadn't really heard that term used. We've heard a variety of different things like a colloquial recusal. And I know you know some of the people involved, particularly on the prosecution side. You know Kim Fox, you know Jesse Jackson, you've known them both for years. Can you give us some insight into how you view the Smollett issue and what impact is it having on the city of Chicago?
Well, first of all politics is local, especially in Chicago. And I live literally two blocks away from where the incident allegedly occurred. I've lived in this neighborhood for 30 years. You get to know your neighborhood. I know the kind of crimes that happen in my neighborhood. We have the occasional carjacking. We've got people this winter who were getting their Canada Goose coats stolen from them, along with their iPhones. You know, I know this. I know the crime in my neighborhood. We don't have crime in the middle of the night in my neighborhood because nobody's out walking around. We're older residential where it's not the nightlife where there's, you know, nightclubs where kids are standing outside at 4 a.m. Things quiet down around midnight. So when I heard about this, I thought, why is anybody going to the all-night subway on a night during the polar vortex where it's so cold that you really should not be outside? So literally, that was the first thing that gave me pause. I was like, why is he walking around on the coldest night of the year? Something doesn't make sense here. Then when he described the hate crime nature of it, I was appalled because, first of all, Chicago is a pretty blue city. We don't have a lot of that. And if people came in from another state or in the suburbs, they wouldn't head to my neighborhood to pick a victim. They would likely head to Boys Town, to the neighborhood that is famous for gay bars and restaurants and nightlife. And if you were going to commit a hate crime and you were targeting gay people, that's likely where somebody like that would go. So the whole thing just didn't make sense. And the more I found out about it, I just felt badly for Smollett in that he must have been in such a bad place mentally that he thought this was going to help him, which is all kinds of crazy in my book. But being Chicagoans, being people who live in our little blue bubble, many of the political leaders jumped on it and said, this is crazy, this is appalling, this is a high-tech lynching, we don't want any of this in our neighborhood. As the story evolved and we found out, well, maybe it's not everything it was supposed to be. And, you know, as happens on high-profile cases, calls got made. Evidently, calls got made behind the scenes. And today, it is still front page here, today that Kim Fox, the state's attorney, has released some of her texts and emails to try to explain what was going on. And one of the things that she said, I'm a friend of Kim Fox and generally very supportive of her, but I like many people in Chicago, I could not understand what was going on during this whole case. But one of the things she said in one of the emails, she said, you know, just because you can charge something doesn't mean you necessarily should. Now, I think as a citizen, Smollett should have to pay back everything for the investigation, all the money that the city of Chicago laid out. I think Smollett should repay. I think he should probably get some probation. But, you know, I don't think he should serve jail time for being an idiot. If we put everybody who was an idiot in jail, our jails would be way more overcrowded than they are now.
You know, let me ask you a quick question. I understand, you know, on the one side, you have the debate of celebrity privilege versus equal justice. But Kim Fox has come out and she's provided a bit of a racial overtone, suggesting that this pushback on her is because she's an African-American woman. And you've got your other friend, Jesse Jackson, standing prominently behind her in the photo shots. Do you really see the challenge of Kim Fox as being driven by racism?
Yes, but only because the specific places that it came from initially and the specific actors who were pushing the criticism against her initially. It was not, you know, like moral outrage by the city. It was a couple of people who were pushing back against her, and it was targeted at her. I don't know if it was targeted at her first because she was a female or first because she was African American. It's always hard to tell whether the racism comes first or the sexism. But again, all politics was local. The criticism at Kim was because people know that she's going to be up for election in a couple of years, and they want to get the first volleys out against her now.
And very quickly, you've had a very interesting mayoral race. You had the first race between two Black women who may have the greatest two names in the history of politics, Lori Lightfoot and Tony Preckwinkle.
Tony's ex-husband's name is Zeus. So if you really
mix. Well, they both had a lot of endorsements. Not surprisingly, they're both Democrats. And yet, Lori Lightfoot got 74% of the vote. How much of that do you think may have been tied to Kim Fox's association with Tony Preckwinkle?
Not very much. People tried to make it that way, but not very much. But what is more important, and what is more important for Joe Biden and for the national candidates, people voted against the machine. People voted against politics as usual. People voted against political experience, and they voted for someone new and for change. We always say that anybody who puts their name on the ballot can get 30% of the vote. Well, it turned out the elected president of the Cook County Board, which is a huge position here in Chicago, and Tony Preckwinkle is also at the same time the head of the Democratic Party of Cook County, which is the vaunted Democratic machine that has existed since before the first Mayor Daley and has been the Democratic powerhouse of the city, the state, maybe even the country. Tony Preckwinkle is the chairman of the Democratic Party, and she could not get more than 26% of the vote in the mayoral race. That is the stunning news, that experience and organization didn't matter.
I totally agree. It might be evidence of what might transpire at a national level. Kitty, in the limited amount of time we have left, where can our listeners go to learn more about you and your political involvement?
You can go look at kurthlampe.com is my webpage, kurthlampe.com. I have a podcast called Girl Pundits, which unfortunately I can't invite you on because I'm dedicated to smart women talking to and about one another. Men can listen, though. We very much invite men to listen. And then there's one other thing I want to talk about. One of my mentees and young people in my life is a social justice rapper named Rhymefest, and he is in a new movie written and directed by Emilio Estevez called The Public. It is about libraries and about the current state of libraries as homeless shelters and social places that solve all of our social ills. But it's not a documentary. It's a really fun movie. It's an interesting movie. You'll laugh. You'll cry. Go check it out. Emilio Estevez's The Public, and look for a guy named Rhymefest who wrote the music and plays a character called Big George.
Excellent. Well, Kitty, I will look forward to listening to your show since I can't be a guest. Sexist.
But I figure the white guys have had all the airtime for a few decades.
Fair comment. It's always a pleasure to talk politics with you. And thanks for giving us the inside scoop on Joe Biden and your friends Kim Fox and Jesse Jackson and Chicago politics in general. And let's do it again sometime soon. Thanks again for joining me on Deconstructed.
Thank you so much for having me, TJ.